from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this special New Year's Day edition of Forum, we bring you two interviews from the archives. First, performer, teacher, and theater director Odessa Jones has spent her rich and varied career merging social activism and theater. She joined us as part of our First Person series on local leaders and innovators. And at 10:30, psychologist and author Daniel Goleman, author of Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence. That's next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. And in this hour, we welcome back Odessa Jones to Forum as part of our series profiling women in the Bay Area who are having an impact and are contributing to the community we live in and making their voices heard. Recently presented with the San Francisco Mayor's Art Award, Odessa Jones is the founder and director of the Medea Project, a theater for incarcerated women, and she's co-artistic director of the voice, dance, and performance company Cultural Odyssey. The daughter of migrant workers and the sister of famed choreographer and dancer Bill T. Jones, she has described herself as an actor of the oppressed whose healing work has helped transform and even save lives and who has become more recently increasingly involved in working with women who have HIV or AIDS. We welcome Odessa Jones to our studio. Amazing, Odessa Jones, and congratulations on your award. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's good to be back at KQED.
And it's good to have you back. And I want to talk about the work you've done because it's really amazing work and talk about your life and all that. But let's go back to what sort of started this. It started almost unpredictably from this perch enough with aerobics. You were teaching aerobics in the city jail.
Yeah, the California Arts Council hired me to teach aerobics to incarcerated women. And I never was an aerobics teacher, but I'm a physical theater performer who danced with Tumbleweed, a dance company back in the day. And I was just fascinated, the idea of what did aerobics have to do with rehabilitation. So I went, and I have eight brothers. So one of my brothers was at Attica when Attica blew up and the insurrection or whatever you want to call it. So I thought I knew something about men imprisoned, but I was not prepared for how many women were imprisoned back in the early 80s. Yeah, it
was. And when did you make the transition to realizing that women in telling their stories and in being artistic could actually heal some of their pain, their internal struggles? I mean, from aerobics, was it a jump or just a natural kind of bridge, to use your word?
Well, they weren't that interested in moving. They were very depressed and angry, and they were sort of forced to go with me to the gym at 850 Bryant Street. And they were curious about me. You know, I often tell the story of how I decided I was going to look like Danielle from Solid Gold. So Solid Gold was this Saturday morning dance show. So I thought, okay, I'm going to get some extensions in my hair and I'll wear beautiful unitards. And I sort of was standing there sort of looking like this and talking to them. And I realized the more I talked about myself, the more interested they were.
Didn't one of them say, why are you telling me about your business?
Yes, yes. One woman, I told him about my daughter had just gotten married, and we were going to have a child, my daughter and her husband. And I was very excited. And one woman was just kind of curious. Because women, it's like kitchen table stuff, you know. I understand that, you know. So all of a sudden, we're talking about babies and love and marriage and... And one woman said, well, why are you telling us your business? And in fact, she was Regina Brown, who went on to be murdered, which inspired my one-woman show, Big Butt Girls, Hard-Headed Women. But she said, why are you telling us your business? And African-Americans, we were taught, you know, everything that happens at home stays at home. And I said, well, I'm interested in finding a way to build a bridge out of here. And she said, well, then you're not the police. I said, no, I'm an artist. And she said, well, what's that? And it became the question that I've been still attempting to answer all these years. What is an artist in marginal
communities? A broker, a magician, an alchemist. You have answered
all
it in many
things,
ways.
Yes. And along came Idris Akamor, who I started to work with Cultural Odyssey, and he gave me a lot of room and latitude to explore it. I mean, he would raise money so that we could, when we took women into a public theater, we could pay them. And thank God for Mike Hennessy, who was at that time the sheriff, county sheriff. And he was very, Mike, wherever you are, you're just fabulous. And he was so good at listening.
You mentioned Big Butt Girls, Hard-Headed Women, which really went to Rome and got a couple of awards and was a Betsy Award particularly. But this was an attempt really to bring those stories to the stage. Yeah?
Well, I wanted to make this piece because I felt like once we started talking to each other and they started sharing their stories, I started to see where my life made sense in this place, because at the same time, I was modeling for Lorraine Caparel, who is a sculptor down in Palo Alto, and we were dealing with the ages of women at the same time, you know, like the crone, the matron, the virgin. And so I would be down there on weekends posing for this visual artist, and all of a sudden I'm looking at the ages of women in the jail, you know, Mama Pearl, Lena. They were all like, that was the virgin, that was the Valkyrie, that was the siren. And I started to capture what they were saying, because we weren't allowed to videotape the women. It was more about me going home and attempting to capture that language. And, you know, I mean, most of us know by now, but 24/7 is really a term from jail, you know, the 411 is a term from jail. So I was like learning another language to be sitting with this woman. And one of the ones that's most still mystifies me is if your lawyer comes on Sunday, you're through with money, which simply means you're going to jail, you're going to do time. And it was like hearing this rich way that people were talking, and I wanted to capture everything. So I'd go home and I'd write it down, and I would talk to Idris Akamor, because we were a couple living together then, and I would just like share these stories with him about these women and what could I do with these characters, you know. And so Big Butt Girls was born out of my need to explain my own situation in the jails as an artist, more than a drama therapist or anything. And it literally went viral. The performance just went off the charts. I was invited everywhere to do it when I thought it was going to be a community project, maybe with inmates watching it.
Well, these theater projects, I mean, you've said for many years now, they reduce recidivism, they reunite families, they rehabilitate and certainly help with abuse and poverty. Can you spell that out to us to a degree? I mean, what metrics do we have to measure those kinds of transformations, and how do you know they're taking place because of essentially filling their souls, as you would put it, I believe,
mm-hmm.
with art?
Mm-hmm. I think that, as Mike Hennessy believed too, that art changes lives. And now there are the variables. There's like housing, mental health issues, which we're still dealing with
drugs.
Gun violence, drugs, all. And it's like women need jobs. They need to feel grounded, and they need to feel like where they need to feel like they're going home. And largely they go back to their mother's house, or if they're really unlucky, the pimp, the predator, the lost boy is waiting at the gate. But the other side of that is that they find voice. If it's nothing more than sitting in a circle and saying, this happened to me, you know, or the whole idea that I'm not a bad person, I'm not alone. And I run into women in the streets from the Medea Project, and a lot of them, you know, we are a nation of shame and stigma, and a lot of them don't want to be really associated with the Medea Project, but they can't help but feel connected to me. And we'll see each other, and they'll tell me what they're doing. I'll meet their babies. And some of them go back to school. You know, they go back to school. But as I said, the variables have to do with having the money to live, to pay the rent, to feed the baby, so the school becomes real. Now, for us in the normal world, we know that this is the ticket to a more financially stable life. But for people who spent their lives doing drugs or being surrounded by people who are doing and selling drugs and the violence that ensues, it's still very nightmarish. to attempt to go back to school.
Well, you said when you went into the jail, it was like you were dropped into hell. And we're talking, by the way, if you just joined us, with Rodessa Jones of the Medea Project and Cultural Odyssey. I heard Medea in my head, and yet I looked online and saw Medea, which is, of course, the name of the Greek heroine. And so I found myself saying Medea, you know, tomato, tomato. But it is the Medea Project.
Yes.
And
because I met a woman in the jails who killed her baby.
Crack cocaine thing?
Yeah, a drug hallucination. But the bottom story, the backstory was that her husband— they had been experimenting as we were in the 80s. You know, cocaine was flying around. They were, like, doing this on the weekends, which a lot of people were. And she became extremely addicted, which studies show that women have a very low tolerance for alcohol and drugs. And he could not, I think he was afraid of her dependence on this substance now. And he wanted out with the child. And what she did was smother the baby. And this became, for me, it was like this stunning reality of how far does it go. And I'd seen A Dream of Passion with Melina Mercury, you know, and Ellen Burstyn, I think, the movie about the actress who goes to Greece to play Medea, and she meets a woman who's in jail for a crime like the ancient crime of Medea. And it was like, it all made sense to me that it would be called the Medea Project.
And when did you start working with women with HIV? When you made that transition?
Oh, it's been 5 years now. 5 years I've been at the UCSF at the Women's HIV Project there, led by Dr. Mocktinger. And it's very funny, Kamala Harris sent me, I don't really know Kamala, but of course we all know Kamala, but she sent me a little note saying you should go to this fundraiser, and it was for the clinic. And I went and I met Dr. Edward Mocktinger, and a lot of the women that were there assisting, they were women that I had known in the jails. And actually I met a woman that had been a student of mine back in the day when I was teaching dance, and her daughter, who was now like in her mid-20s, came up to me and said, "Rodessa, you don't remember me, but you used to carry me around so my mother could work, could study." She said, "And you know, I am her name slips my mind, but all of a sudden this woman who was a baby girl is remembering me, and Eddie Mocktinger meets me at the same time, and we start talking about how I could use the methodologies of the Medea Project, the storytelling techniques, to get women to come out about their status, because it makes for a healthier body if your family knows what you're going through, if your employers know, if the community knows." And he said, "Well, I challenge you to take the same storytelling techniques." And
it's difficult against the stigma and all that. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've certainly had conversations along those lines on this program. Recently, you've been in South Africa.
And yes.
Yeah. What
I've been working
there?
I performed at the Yari Yari Conference in New York about 9 years ago now. The Jane Cortez, the great poet who just passed, it was her conference, but it was a conference of voices and ideas and performances. And I performed a bit from Deep in the Night, which was a piece about women facing 50 with HIV. And Rajni Moonsami from Urban Voices in Johannesburg was there. And she said, "If I could raise the money, would you come to South Africa and perform this work?" And Big Butt Girls, which I did both there.
And forgive me, there is a kind of pedigree here, because there's some African ideology behind Cultural Odyssey, right?
Yes. Well, Idris Akamor is a fantastic multiple instrumentalist who went to Africa when he was a student at Antioch. And so Idris said, sort of, he prepared me somewhat for culturally how rich it would be to be in Africa, as well as Cultural Odyssey. Part of our mission statement is the search for human culture. And I really believe that human culture began in Africa. And then to be there working in the prisons is astoundingly beautiful, terrifying to be there. But I feel it's much saner than here.
Well, you have about 70 hours of footage of these inmates rehearsing and performing in Johannesburg, and we hope a feature film will be next in the works.
Before I'm too old to dream.
Well, no, never too old to dream. We're talking to Rodessa Jones, and as I said earlier, sister of Bill T. Jones. What is it in your genes, or I mean, this dancing power and choreographic power? Talk about your. I know your mother was a major influence in your life.
Yes.
How is that figure?
Well, my mother had been a gospel singer, but also Christianity sort of reared its head, and so she was led to believe that.
Should I mention you're wearing a Hindu blouse here this morning?
Yes, Ganesh travels with me everywhere. One of the women in the prison gave me my first Ganesh T-shirt, and then in South Africa, they're everywhere. But, you know, Ganesh is a remover of all obstacles, and it's kind of strange to be an African-American woman traveling around the world. And I don't know. I beg anybody's pardon if they find it offensive that I have this pagan god on my shirt. But
I was
works.
Just thinking about your gospel Christian background. That's all.
No, my mother was trapped in that she, first of all, because of the times. You were a success if you were married and you were bonded with somebody just economically. But I think she and my father really liked each other. I mean, that was like my
liked
mother,
as opposed to loved?
Well, I think that they started out liking each other. And I think that as the time went on, she grew to really love him because he freed her from my mother with her sisters and my grandmother had lived on the Cannon plantation. Literally all their lives, you know, and my dad comes along, this handsome, rail. My father actually had met Woody Guthrie, you know. My father jumped the rails and did, he was just a wild guy, handsome. And he said he saw, one morning he woke up in Valdosta, Georgia, and he opens his eyes and there's these beautiful legs walking by and he says to his buddy, Charles Taylor, says, I'm going to marry those legs. And so he finds a job at the commissary and knocks on the back door of this man's house. The man says, my cook will tell you where to put your things. It was my mother. And but back to my mom, I think my mother had children. She had children because the Bible said so. So she ended up being pregnant 19 times. Mm. And she ended up with 12 of us. And we were poor. My father was a migrant crew leader. But as Nikki Giovanni would say, I didn't know I was poor. You know?
She said in that poem about Chicago, but we were happy.
Yes, yes. And so we sang and danced and entertained each other constantly. And my mother, I just wrote on my Facebook page, my mother always said, love one another, forgive one another, and even ask God to forgive you, you know, because there's a lot of fighting amongst that many children. And she wasn't having it. I remember my first acting role was the messenger in Rumpelstiltskin in the fourth grade. And my mother, who worked in the fields, got it together, got me my costume, came to the school, and of course we're falling apart on stage, laughing and being children. And my mother just stepped down and walked down the aisle, and she said, Rhodessa Jones, you hold your head up. Don't you bring me to an open shame. And she said to the rest of my class, she says, and don't the rest of y'all be so common. And the teachers were so grateful. The teachers were like, thank you, Mrs. Jones. But that was the beginning. But no, I think we're just fabulously gifted, if I must say so myself.
But you said you had a brother in Attica. What?
Yes, my brother Richard. My brother Richard was the child.
Was a chain gang, in fact, wasn't it?
My brother was on the chain gang. He was 15 in Rayford, Florida. And he was just the child that my mother had when she married my dad. So he was, he was sort of a displaced personality in a certain way. And also my older brothers were all like real charmers and ladies men. But this boy was like 14. He's running around with these guys that are like 20, my older brothers. And I think it was all a part of him being misled in a lot of ways because he was a wonderful guy.
You were pregnant at 16.
Yes.
And had a child at 16. And I guess to support yourself, you're a new dancer.
Well, when I left home, but thank God for my mother and father, because I was going to give up my daughter to through the Salvation Army, I think it was the Florence Crittenden's
Home
for Girls.
Home, yeah.
And I had arranged that myself, that I was going to go and meet this major, somebody or other. And my mother came in that I was going to meet this woman on Monday. I was going to meet the woman on Monday. My mother came in on Sunday, and I was in the bathtub, and she had 19 pregnancies. She knew right away I was pregnant. And she said, we got to tell your daddy about this. And all of a sudden it was an open secret. And I wasn't giving away any child of theirs. And they were there for me. And then I left home and moved to San Francisco. And my daughter got a scholarship to the Marin Academy. And her father fell down on his commitments. And all of a sudden I had no money for fees and this kind of stuff. So I started dancing nude downtown at Fantasies in the Flesh. You know, it was like scary but wild. I mean, I was young, and my daughter made me my first tapes, because by now my daughter's 14, so she made me these great tapes with Prince and Pete Seeger and the Silver Bullet Band. So I had this, and Ray Charles, and these people would come out the street like, who is dancing to this music? And I got to organizing the women a little bit down there too. I told them that we're not going to clean up. They're going to have to clean up. We work for them. We're not maids here at this place.
Now, the Medea Project used to work with, I mean, as I understood it, there was a circle and there was working, starting with movement and then story sharing, mm-hmm. and ultimately monologue.
Yes. Yeah. The monologues grew out of the conversations. And in the beginning, it was Sean Reynolds and myself. And Sean had already been working in the jails teaching, life lessons. She was dealing with health. She was dealing with just trying to get them to see themselves as whole entities. And I wanted to bring in theater as a medium for them to talk about whatever came up in Sean's workshop. So we put the workshops together. And it was at those workshops that Louise Nevelson had said to the world, the sculptress Louise Nevelson, she said, you must move. It doesn't matter the medium, but move. And then I was from a dancing background with Tumbleweed, which is headed by Teresa Dickinson here in San Francisco. And so movement gets your breath going. It frees you up to play. And I had to simplify it. I mean, we did everything at Blind Man Bluff, Red Light, Green Light, Simon Says, but it nudged the memory, which is actually the name of my handbook that I'm working on about making theater with incarcerated women. Nudging the memory through movement. And then, you know, once we're kind of out of breath and we're kind of loose and feeling more like girls again, then the questions come in. They can begin with something as simple as, how did you get your name? You know, when your mother comes, ask your mother who is your great-great-grandmother versus demanding cigarettes and candy and commissary. What was your father's name? What happened to your father? Were they married? And women were just kind of like, they were very interested that I was interested in their backstory. But then it would flood over and you'd find out about incest and the violence that they lived with, and the fact that their mothers some of their mothers were still in the life, I mean, selling drugs, whatever. But I'd say, you know what? Your mother's never been arrested. Isn't there something to learn from your mother? You know, and the conversations would deepen that way, and women would all want to talk about who they were, or just a simple game as, I remember my mother, or how do we put ourselves in harm's way? If you could talk to your younger self, given what you know now, let's write about that. Let's talk about that. Let's pretend that I'm your 14-year-old self. Talk to me. Tell me what it is that you've learned. Teach me. And all of the stuff becomes the fodder for the monologues, which make up a Theater for Incarcerated Women.
You've been listening to a special encore edition of Forum. Our guest was performer and teacher Rodessa Jones. She joined us as part of our first-person series on leaders, innovators, and others who make the Bay Area unique. Stay with us for another program from our archives.